The Legal Lowdown on Kerry Today.
Yeah, Mary McGillicuddy, solicitor and lecturer in law in the Munster Technological University, is with me on the line. Miriam, good morning to you. Thanks for joining us again.
Good morning, Jerry, and good morning, listeners. Great to talk to you there.
Great stuff. Miriam, we've lots of views and comments coming into us. Some have come in this morning, but we want to get to some that were leftover queries from last month because a lot of people had contacted us. We'll start with this one. A family member is currently employed with a company for 10 years. She's reaching 66th birthday. Her employer wants her to sign a yearly contract now. Is this legal? She's very loyal, punctual member of staff, very efficient at her job. Her current contract was signed 10 years ago and does not have a finish date. Any advice?
Yeah, and I suppose she'd prefer to stay on her present contract and just keep it as a rollover. This is a very topical area, and I think Micheál Martin recently announced that he was going to get rid of mandatory retirement at 66. But there is a code of practice produced by the work, available through the Workplace Relations Commission, a code of practice on longer working. You notice how it avoids any reference to age, which is great. It's just about working, you know, longer into our later years, and that does provide that there should be discussion between the employer and the employee. And this employee obviously has an objection to what's happening at the moment, so it would be better to have a discussion maybe in the light of that code of practice, and maybe mention that code of practice to her employer and see if she could just roll over on her present contract, and what her long-term plans are and what the employer's long-term plans are, and to kind of, you know, compromise between the two of them there.
Approach it that way.
I mean, if there's a union in the workplace, they could approach the employer also for her. But there is that code practice, and we're going to see more changes down the line, as I say, with this getting rid of the mandatory retirement age. You see, I suppose mostly in the public service there are set retirement ages, and they've been extended now. But then in the private sector, it very much depends on the contract of employment. The current practice maybe implied terms in the workplace as to when employees leave the employment as they get older. So every employment is different, but it is quite clear now that employers have to be very careful if they're trying to say you have to retire. They really have to have very strong reasons to justify that, not allowing somebody work on into their later years if they want to. So, as I say, it is something we'll see changes. And there have been a number of cases before the Workplace Relations Commission where, for example, if this lady got this new contract for a year and then the employer let her go, that there would be grounds then for an unfair dismissal case.
Yeah.
So
as long as she could show, I suppose, her performance hadn't changed or there weren't any issues or any dissatisfaction with her performance in the job.
Exactly. That's right. So there have been a number of cases recently in relation to that, protecting people as they go into longer working arrangements beyond 65.
Yeah, and this is becoming more and more of an issue now, Miriam, as people are healthier for longer. Thankfully, the age expectancy, life expectancy is increasing in this country, and people feel fitter and more able to work for longer.
That's right. And it's not like people's social life, a lot of their self-esteem, maybe their identity, would be linked into the workplace. And if they feel energetic enough to stay on, that they shouldn't be forced to leave. And certainly that seems to be Micheál Martin's plan. And that was announced 2 days ago.
It's a changing area, so keep a close eye on it, I suppose, is the answer.
Exactly. Yeah, that's it.
Okay. Miriam, a couple of more queries coming in here. One listener gets in touch and says, asks the question, how long does it take an executor to do their duty on a deceased's will? Is there a legal or typical time limit? Who can view a copy of the will and when can they do this? Can the family access the property before the will is read? Would a family member, not the executor, have the authority or a right to change locks on the property?
Yeah, that sounds like quite a tough scenario here. But the executor is the person who manages the will, and manage the person's estate after their death. So they do have a kind of an obligation to look after the property and to ensure that it's insured and that it doesn't diminish or deteriorate in value. The executor is also the person who decides who should see the will. Now, traditionally, there was the old reading of the will, but we don't see that as much anymore. But certainly family members, I suppose, from the point of view of accountability, transparency and clarity, it would be good practice for an executor to make people who are beneficiaries in a will aware of the will or even what their benefit is on their own, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, and that is the kind of thing. Like, in terms of going into the property then, it's not advisable unless things are sorted out from the point of view, are you here or some sort of communication can be had?
Yes, yeah. I mean, they're ideally, they should have notified the family members as to what's happening. So those family members would be, you know, feel comfortable about what's going on and not being kept in the dark. So there's not, you know, there is nothing worse than non-communication to the family members. And it can be quite upsetting. And the access to the property, I suppose that was one point they mentioned there. And the executor is the person in charge of the property. So they decide what happens with it. So they may lose access to the property as a result if with the executor being in charge and deciding who can go in and who can't go in. Mm. But obviously that can be very upsetting as well if that's been their family home.
Yeah.
And maybe a bit more communication around it as to what's happening would be beneficial there.
Yeah, certainly would. Any advice for someone who got no support from their union on an issue? They picked the side of another member of that same union, even though that person was totally in the wrong. Now, this is a subjective way of looking at it to this person's view, and we don't know the details of whether it was right or wrong, but what you say to that, Miriam?
Yeah, I mean, that's a difficult one in the sense that the union is supposed to be there for all the employees, and it works very well in the collective bargaining situation in the sense that they deal with the employees en masse and then with the employer. But when there's individual employees involved, maybe one person got to them first and is complaining about bullying, and then the other person who's maybe accused of the bullying is left out in the cold in relation to maybe representation by the same union. Now, the best way to deal with it ideally would be to have maybe the local union rep looking after one person and then having a rep from another area looking after the other person.
And unions may have their own procedures for dealing with that.
They may have their own rules for dealing with that. And it's no harm to alert them to a conflict of interest early and make them aware of it, and that one would like to have their own representation separately. I mean, for example, with the Legal Aid Board, if one person goes into one law centre and then the other person needs representation, they'll get it from another law centre, because it's very important that they be seen or that they have separate representation. So hopefully they should approach their union and try and get representation from a totally separate representative from maybe a different part of the union.
Yeah.
So they've adequate representation in the matter.
Yeah, okay. Miriam, there's another query here I want to get to. I bought a €100 hotel voucher on December 20th, 2019, and I couldn't use it because of COVID. But when I went to use it 2 months ago, they wouldn't honour it because the 5-year valid legislation came into effect. But apparently they're telling me I bought that voucher before this new regulation came in. I'm disgusted with this hotel. Can you explain what's the story with hotel vouchers? Is it 5 years? The date is the 2nd of December 2019. Now, this is there's been work done by the government, the legislation in relation to this in the meantime, but the hotel is obviously arguing, look, sorry, that was bought before these rules came in.
That's right. I really feel for this listener. It's really frustrating, and it's awful, really, because she had the date as the 20th of December. In fact, it's the 2nd of December.
Yes.
Just putting that in case her voucher was between the 2nd of December and the 20th of December. But unfortunately, if she bought the voucher before that date, she doesn't have the benefit of the five-year rule. Now, I think with COVID, there would be very strong argument that the length of time for the voucher should be extended by the 2 years
yes.
that we had COVID.
Yeah, because she only had it from December. The restrictions and rules for the pandemic came in March. That's only 3 months, and you'd want to be adding on 2 years to whatever time limit the voucher was
yeah.
for things to have returned back to normal, let's say this spring, I suppose you'd call it that.
Yeah, no, if she bought the voucher on the 20th of December, she's post the D-date when the five-year rule came in, which
yes.
was the 2nd of December.
Yes.
So I think she's home and dry.
You think she's dry, home and dry with that?
Yeah, it sounds like it, on the five-year rule. Now, that's provided that date is correct
yes.
from her facts
yes.
there.
She'd want to go back to them with that, definitely, first
yeah,
of all.
Yeah, first of all, that would be the first protocol. But then I was thinking about it. I mean, there is the idea that COVID would have interrupted, is a kind of an outside interrupting event, and that the voucher should be extended by that 2 year period anyway when they were closed
yeah.
or unavailable for booking, or that she couldn't book due to the current situation. So, I mean, I would have thought there would be a strong point to bring up with the hotel about going to the small claims court if they don't sort it out. And I mean, €100 voucher, if they're booking any hotel, they're going to be paying extra anyway.
Yes.
So I think she went along with any kind of a strong argument.
They should
sort her out. Yeah,
yeah, they really should. Okay, yeah. Miriam, keep us your comments and views coming in. So we're going to have a little bit more of queries here coming in from Miriam McGillicuddy in the time that's left to us on the programme. We've, you know, some other queries around vouchers post that date. Does one have to use it in one go? Another one says, my name is wrong and the voucher just mean I cannot use it.
Yeah, and one doesn't have to use it in one go, and one can use part of the voucher and then get maybe a refund or money back or another voucher for the remaining amount.
Yes.
So that's in the new rules as well, which is really important, Gerry. And then if the name is wrong in the voucher, they can't be charging extra or not allowing you to use it. They should provide a change of name. If for example, it had your maybe the name spelt wrong, for example, on the voucher, that they should sort that out.
Another caller identifying or asking a question in relation to something that's becoming all too more frequent, unfortunately, in our society. Is there any agency that handles scam/defrauding cases?
It's the Guards, basically. The Gardaí National Cyber Crime Bureau and the Guards around the country are our port of call in relation to these. But there is very useful help on citizens' information, which is excellent, all about the different types of scams, which can come, by the way, in letters, in emails, in phone calls, in texts. And I mean, I'm sure loads of people are getting those calls in from abroad, distant countries abroad.
Yeah.
And so they're coming from all angles, and it's very important to be wary about them. And if one suspects a scam, of course, never give out one's bank account details and all that. But if one suspects a scam, it's no harm to make the Guards aware of it so that they know what kinds of scams are circulating in the area and they can warn people about them.
Yes.
And now we will hopefully, once the new safety online legislation comes in, we'll probably have our online safety commissioner and more have a one-stop shop in relation to this. But in the meantime, the Guards are the first port of call. There's also, you know, loads of tips on citizens' information and on the Garda website about protecting yourself against online fraud and scams. And also, I mean, if they do actually take money, you could get back. I mean, it's important, first of all, if it was maybe through Facebook or some other organisation, that one notifies them that people are scamming through them. And also maybe to contact the bank and see if one can do a charge back on the card or something of that nature. So to take immediate action to see if one can get the money back as well.
Yeah, okay, that would be a key thing to try and do in relation to that. Miriam, listen, we're going to leave it there. My thanks to you for talking to us again this month. Lots of queries that we will continue to keep and get to next month. But thanks for talking to us, Miriam.
Thank you, Gerry. Thank you, listeners.